This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Over the past 16 years this program has been on the air, I hope, and I think I know, I have introduced you to quite a few composers you did not know. Though that can be for many reasons, the most common is that the composer is young and up and coming. But over the next 2 weeks, we'll chat with composers most likely new to you, but both very established and accomplished, but with very different backgrounds and life stories. This week it is the New York-born Edward Smaldone. His Italian-Irish upbringing, filled with music in the home, is no doubt a common one, steeped in Americana and very urban in its details. He would get all the way through and into high school performing music, but not being able to read it, decipher it, or analyze it. He was a talented gigger, but once set on the course, he would land at Queens College, in that borough of New York City, at the Aaron Copland School of Music, first as an undergrad, then postgrad student, then as faculty, eventually heading up the department, and has now been associated with Queens College for over 40 years. He is as proud of that teaching experience as of the music he has composed, which for so long has not seen wide circulation. And at a time with COVID that no composers can hear their works performed in front of a live audience, as fortune and opportunity would have it, a bevy of recordings have come out in the last months featuring my guest's works and letting us get to know and appreciate his music. From a portrait disc of his works released on the Ablaze label, you're listening to the third and final movement of his suite for violin and piano, Scott Jackson the violinist and Matthew Umphrey's piano. I spoke with Edward Smaldone via Zoom this past week. Happy to be talking today with composer and teacher Edward Smaldone. Amidst everything we're going through in the world, which is writ large, congrats, I guess, on these new CDs, which have been released over the last 6-9 months, with your music on them. You mentioned once, I read, where if a composer's kind of charting his or her goals, one of the goals is to have your works recorded.
Yes.
And we're in a time now when you can't hear your works performed in front of a live audience. So this release of this stuff has to be kind of gratifying amidst everything else going on around you.
It really is. First of all, thanks very much for having me here. I'm really happy to have the attention on these CDs because I'm very proud of them. And the fact that over the course of March 2020 until January 2021, there were four different CDs that came out. It had nothing to do with COVID. It's just that these things, there's such a long arc to the completion of a project like this, that they just all seem to converge at this moment. And two of them are full-length CDs of my music, which, you know, again, they were years-long projects that just seemed to blossom at the same moment. And then the others are some things that have a single piece on each one.
Timing has not been friendly to any of the performing arts, but
no.
For you, it's been okay the last few months as far as...
Well, yeah. And frankly, the last year has taught us how much we value live performance, how important it is, how much the connection with people in a live setting. Also, the sort of high wire act of a live performance, I find very exciting. Some of the performers might be a little more terrified than me because I tend to write rather virtuosic music. But the recorded performances are real documents for a composer, especially a modern composer, that we have at least one hopefully supervised performance of the pieces to really document what it's about. And hopefully, I hope it really generates other performances. It would make me so happy to know that someone heard a piece of mine and said, wow, I'd like to do that at a concert. So
that's
some of that
one of
happens.
The goals of recordings. If there was ever an example of a composer putting down roots, and in your case, it's Queens College and the Aaron Copland School of Music, you'd be it, because technically, from your student days, you've been there since 78, which is now 43 years.
It's 74.
Was 74, when I, earlier
was when
than
I,
that.
Was when I started. I actually, back in, I guess it would have been 2014, one of the CDs that just came out started with a concert that I organized in 2014. The spring of 2014 was 40 years to the moment, more or less, to when I first set foot on the Queens College campus as a high school senior. I showed up with my little nylon string guitar, which I really didn't know how to play, and I auditioned, and I basically could have camped on the campus and never left.
So before we talk about Queens, let's back the truck up before that. Your family background, their musicality, the support you got, maybe early teachers, what you were listening to, but when you got into Queens, and then you mentioned the guitar, were there other instruments, you know?
Well, so I come from, I think, a very musical family, but I'm the only professional musician, with the exception of, I had a great aunt who played the cello in vaudeville houses. She did a tour of Missouri once. Can you imagine how exciting that would have been in around 1910 or something like that? And I've got old photos of her, you know, with her band, which consisted of a motley assortment of four or five musicians and a comedian. That was what they traveled with. But my immediate family, my father had a beautiful voice, and my mother was a good singer also. They led song at church. They got me to go to church because somebody gave me an electric bass and said, go play in the, you know, the rock mass. You know, we sang a lot as kids. My father taught us how to sing in harmony. I learned how to sing in harmony when I was like 6 years old. I didn't know what I was doing. But, you know, I sing this and you sing that and it sounds good together. We figured that out. We used to sing in the car. We used to sing at parties. We had a big family, big Italian, Irish family. But I never really had any formal lessons until I was like a senior in high school. I played the guitar. I taught myself. And I was playing in bands and doing ear training by listening to Jimi Hendrix records and Creedence Clearwater and the Allman Brothers and all these guys from the late 60s and early 70s and figuring out where to put my fingers to make the notes happen. But I had no idea what I was doing. I wouldn't have known one note from another on a staff or on the guitar. I just knew I put my fingers here and the right note came out. I played guitar and banjo and mandolin. I taught myself how to play enough of all of those to play the shows that we did in high school. There was a teacher there. Her name was Sister Margaret Palliser. She was probably 6 years older than the rest of us. She was quite young at the time. And I remember watching her. We were doing MAME. I had a banjo solo. The only reason I played banjo is because the guy that played the guitar book, which was supposed to also include the banjo, refused to learn the banjo part. So I was a guitar player, but I raised my hand. I'd like to be in the show. So I played the banjo. And I remember watching this woman. I mean, she was a nun, it still is. But she just walked over to the piano with no music and played every song in the show and then said, nah, that's a little high for you. And then transposed it just by ear, you know? Yeah. And I thought this was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. I said, I got to learn how to do that. around that time in high school, I joined a band. I was in several bands prior to that, but I was invited to join a band that had a three-piece horn section. So this was a band that was going to play Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Chicago and the Ohio Players, Tower of Power, right, and groups like that. And I went to the first rehearsal and the guy gave me a sheet of paper, said, here's your part. I said, what's that? I had no idea what to do with anything. I mean, I could read a chord chart. You know, I knew what the names of the chords were, but I didn't know how to read anything. I started to get serious about it. I said, you know, this is something I might want to do. And there was a guy in the band, the guy that did all the arrangements, and he showed me a score. He said, look at this. And he put on a record of Mussorgsky's Night on Bald Mountain. And I was like, wow, this sounds, wow, listen to that. Wow, what a band. Look at that. And then he said, yeah, and look at this. And he showed me the score. You know, the fact that one led to the other had not really occurred to me at that point. And I said, well, this is something I got to get involved with. So I took theory class in high school, could barely read music, but I was taking theory class. I started taking piano lessons. That's when I learned how to read treble and bass clef. Still didn't really know how to read the notes on the guitar, but I was playing a little piano and I played, you know, Haydn sonatas, and I was not a great pianist, but I was starting to learn things. And then in the spring of 1974, I showed up at Queen's College, auditioned playing my own arrangement of Greensleeves. They said, yeah, okay, sure. And they let me in. And not only that, because I had been studying theory, I was actually in an advanced theory class. So, you know, I was just eating it up. And the people that were there when I was an undergraduate were Carl Schachter, Charles Burkhardt, George Pearl, Huell Weisgall, Henry Weinberg, Henry Burnett, you know, a lot of these people, all the textbooks, the new approach to sight singing, which was a big sight singing book, was written by the guys that taught at Queen's College. The Burkhardt Anthology was a book written by my colleague at Queen's College. And I had just really just stumbled onto it. I really had done no research.
When were the first creations? I mean, you said you did an arrangement of Greensleeves, but when did you start to put pen to paper that was your first originals? Was that at Queens?
Yes, it was. So by the time I was a junior, you know, in about 2.5 years, I ran through the theory curriculum and I actually started taking graduate classes. So I was in George Pearl's graduate analysis class and Henry Weinberg had an analysis class and a history class. And I started studying with some of those guys and writing. I wrote a 17-minute string quartet. I really... didn't know what I was doing, but I was trying. You know, I was just writing stuff all the time. So basically, when I finished the undergraduate degree in 78, I said, well, you know, I'm kind of not done with these guys. I was looking around for where else to go for graduate school. I knew I wanted to do that. And by the way, at that point, I was making my living as a guitar player. I was playing in clubs and fairs and weddings and things like that. It was pretty clear to me that I didn't want to be putting on a tuxedo as the prime source of my income for the rest of my life on a Saturday night. Actually, that was a prescient decision, because a lot of that business has dried up. There's very few guys that are really making a good living doing that. I was making a pretty good living for 19 years old. I could go out and do one gig and make my rent. You know, I was doing 6-8 a month. I was doing okay. But then I sort of stayed for my master's degree. And then all these people, including many more from CUNY, were at the Graduate Center. So I just kept going at the Graduate Center. And at that point, this is in the early 80s, from like 1980 to 86 was when I did my PhD. I was teaching as an adjunct at Queen's College. I was the associate director of their new pre-college program. So I was doing a lot of classroom teaching for young kids. And I was playing in clubs. And I was taking classes in my PhD and eventually doing my dissertation. It was busy.
Yeah, that's about parallel when I was doing my graduate work too, and I was in Chicago.
Yeah.
More music from my guest Edward Smaldone, and from that Portrait CD released on Ablaze Records, the closing minutes of the third and final movement titled Nocturne, from his Three Scenes from the Heartland, as performed by Matthew Umphreys. Thank you.
Talk about this tenure at Queens, you know, maybe kind of an Edward Smaldone timeline, because there are highlights, there are things you've implemented there that have to be things you're quite proud of that you've done over these decades there, bringing the program along.
So my good friend, Bruce Saylor, who's a composer and professor at Queens, he says, yes, you know, we're composers, but we're, you know, at a certain sense, we're school teachers. And it's a noble profession, frankly. I was very involved in pedagogy and in teaching. As an undergraduate, I started as a music education major, but I decided that I wasn't going to teach in a high school. I said, you know, that's not for me. So I dropped that. I've spent a lot of time in the classroom. And after I got my PhD in 86, between 86 and 89, I was sort of, you know, part-time adjunct in a lot of places. And then in 89, I got my tenure track appointment at Queens College. A job came up and I applied, and I'm pretty sure that the reason they chose me over some of the other people that applied was because of my work in the classroom. Because at that point, I hadn't done that much. I'd written some pieces. I had organized a concert series in Long Island City called Sounds from the Left Bank, where we did chamber music at a place called PS1. It's now MoMA Queens. It's the Museum of Modern Arts Queens branch. It was not that in the 80s. It was kind of a rundown, unused school that they let us put concerts in. You know, so I was an assistant professor, and then I was an associate professor, and I got tenure and all that. That basically was the 90s, while I was also raising three children. My wife and I met in sight singing class in 1974.
Your roots go everywhere at a school.
You're not getting me out. But in 2002, I was invited to be the director of the School of Music. And from 2002 until 2016, I was the director of the Aaron Copland School of Music. The very first thing that happened in the very first semester that I was director is that six of my colleagues left. Well, you know, three of them retired. One went to the Graduate Center. Somebody died. Sir Roland Hanna was the jazz professor. And that was the semester that he passed away very suddenly. And we had a new president, the new president of the college, James Myskins, who was very favorably disposed to the School of Music and to the arts. So that combination, you know, we had the support of the administration, and I had this vacuum. The very first thing that I had to do over the first 4, 5, 6 years of my tenure was hiring new people. So we hired a lot of people. And during that time, we hired a number of performers, and the balance of the faculty shifted a little bit. When I was a student, almost everybody was a composer. No matter what you taught, you were a composer. Now it was a little more evenly divided, and we had a lot of people in performance, and the program grew. It was during this time that the jazz program developed. I can't really take credit for that. I think the faculty that we had, it started with Roland Hanna and Jimmy Heath, but then they left, and we had Michael Mossman and David Berkman and Antonio Hart, and recently Dennis McCrell. These are huge names in the jazz world. And we had a huge international following for the jazz program because it wasn't that expensive and it was in New York. And so it really became a magnet for people that wanted to come to New York from China, from Japan, from Germany, from Italy, from everywhere. And these guys all went all over the world playing. And, you know, it says in their resume that they teach in New York. And then the people would look and see how much does it cost to get a jazz degree from Juilliard and how much does it cost to get a jazz degree from Queens College. We did okay. We got a lot of people. I've also managed over the 14 years of my directorship to build the endowments of the School of Music. I've worked closely with the development area, and we've developed a lot of good relationships, especially with the retired and retiring faculty. So, you know, the music faculty have been extremely generous, and their families have been very generous to the School of Music. And we've also had a bunch of friends. There was a woman by the name of Beatrice Shocker Myers. Never met the woman. We have no idea who she was. She was all by herself. She had no family, but she left 80% of her estate to the School of Music. It was $1.6 million.
Wow.
The other 20% she left to some other school in New York, Juilliard. You might have heard of it.
Yeah.
But here's a woman that loved music, lived in Queens, wanted to do something special. And now we've got this money. We put it in the bank. You know, we give out the interest income as scholarships.
It's all great work for a really great music school, which is just happens to be in one of the greatest cities in the world that has other great music schools around it as well.
Right.
Let's listen to the first major work of my guest, Edward Smaldone, free from academic coursework, and also from a new CD of his works titled Once and Again on the New Focus label. This is his double duo. Past Cadenza guest Tara Helen O'Connor on flute, Charles Nydick clarinet, Daniel Phillips violin, and Marcy Rosen cello. Thank you.
you as a composer have this kind of safety zone of being at the school.
Right.
I mean, you're not relying on commissions with your composing to make a living, blah, 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 which is great, but it can also kind of be a double-edged sword, can it not? Where the drive to compose, the recognition, the taking risks. I mean, just talk about your position as opposed to a composer who may not be ensconced at a school.
Right. Well, yes. So the fact that I've got a paycheck means that I don't have to pander to an audience for acceptance or write a piece of music that an orchestra can learn and perform in half a rehearsal. I can put demands on the performers that, frankly, you know, limit how frequently my music gets played because there's a significant buy-in to make something happen. I also have my own sort of personal strategy that, you know, I like to set the bar high enough to keep the children away. I'm not really interested in 10-year-olds playing my music. Look, there are wonderful composers doing lots of good work, writing pieces for middle school band or for high school orchestra and that sort of thing. I've tried, actually, while my children were going through school. I said, you know, if I write something, it's really hard to do. It's really hard to do something that, to me, that spoke to the kind of music that I'd like to be able to write. But at the same time, I'm not really interested in writing music that is purely in this stratosphere of esoteric statement that no one can understand. One of the things I used to say was that I really wanted my music to be respected by and to appeal to George Pearl and my mother-in-law. Yeah, that's a tall order because it's got to have enough meat on the bone for George Pearl to pay attention, but it's got to have a certain amount of surface attractiveness for the general public, not for somebody that does. If you're somebody that doesn't like or has never been to a classical music concert, you might find it, you know, dissonant and off-putting. But if you've got some experience, my music, I feel, kind of moves in the large architectural arc that people are familiar with, if you're familiar with concert music.
Which kind of begs the question, how has your music changed over the decades? I mean, one of the CDs we mentioned at the top that is all your music has come out on the New Focus label is titled Once and Again, which features works that you have gone back to and revised or retooled. I know when I was studying composition in the undergraduate level, my composition teacher, who's passed on now, but he's like a second father to me. I know I was young, but one of his mantras to me was, don't worry about what you've written, write something new. Always moving forward, the shark, right? So I'm just curious because you must see value in the older works, yet for this recording, wanted to tinker with them.
Yeah, well, a model for this, to a certain extent at least, is Mahler. You know, Mahler, because of his practical experience as a conductor of his own music especially, you know, he would work very hard and he had a fantastic imagination. And then he'd get up there and he'd do the first performance and say, you know what, that spot over there needs a little of this. And now that I hear it. So first of all, I never wrote a piece that didn't get a performance.
Right.
So, you know, it was very important to me that I got to hear the music. And this, especially since I'm such an old man, that this goes back to long before the days when you could hear a pretty good representation of your music via MIDI. Right. So the only way you could hear what the music actually sounded like was to try to bang it out on the piano or to get some people to really play it and perform it. That's when you really found out how steep the climb was to get to the performance that you really wanted. I don't compose slowly, I have to say, but you know, I'm not at it all the time because I've got so many other things going on. So for example, the oldest piece on the CD is a piece called Double Duo, which was written in 1987. It was the first piece that I wrote after I finished my PhD. And the PhD, I wrote a string quartet for the PhD, for this part of the dissertation. It's a big, dramatic, complex work. It was supposed to be, because its primary hurdle is to pass muster with a bunch of serious academics. I worked really hard on that piece to also make it something that had a kind of a, you know, a surface sparkle that would attract an audience. That was always very important to me. But with the next piece, I didn't have to worry about anybody. I didn't have anyone looking over my shoulder. So that piece, Double Duo, has a little more of the sort of the energy of jazz and popular music and the kinds of things that I'd spent so much of my life performing. It doesn't sound like a pop piece, but it's just got a little more, you know, sort of surface energy woven into it. And actually, it's a piece that has gotten quite a few performances over the years. And as I hear each performance, like, you know, like Mahler, you know, this one needs another 10 seconds. Then I need a little bit over here, a little, and you tweak this and that. Putting it on this recording, especially with these amazing performers, Daniel Phillips, Marcy Rosen, Tara Helen O'Connor, and right. Charlie Nydick. This is it. I'm finished tinkering with this at this point. It's been a long time, but also, right. you know, this is going to be the definitive performance. So I actually didn't do a lot with it for this performance, but I'm really done with this one for now. You know, and also when you've got something that you're preparing for a recording, it's an opportunity to make sure everything is in order. It's about as close to graven in stone as you're going to get for a composition like this. So you want to make sure it's right.
Yeah, I was just curious because a lot of composers, they either want to go back like you did and sort of fix this and tidy this up or tweak this. And other composers will say, yeah, that's it. I wrote it back in 99. That's it. You know, I'm
yeah.
That's the piece. You know, you've been at the Aaron Copland School of Music and your music is wholly American and I would say very New York in some ways as well.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about that, which might be a little bit hard, but I mean, influences, aspects, traits, which you think make your music that it could only have come from an American composer.
Yeah, well, composers like Copland, Barber, Elliot Carter, you know, these people have been a strong influence. But I came to the study of classical music sort of all at once. I wasn't a kid that played, you know, the violin in an orchestra and was listening to classical music his whole life and then, you know, grew into it. I was listening, you know, to the Beethoven string quartets and Mozart operas and Schoenberg and Berg and Webern all at the same time. And I was also something of a student of jazz. I mean, I was never a hardcore, you know, bebop guitar player or something like that. But, you know, jazz by way of the sort of jazz rock of the 70s, you know, which relies on improvisation and energy. And I think that it's a kind of an amalgamation of all of those things that right. my musical language relies on. I try to be true to all of that without imitating any of it.
That's a tough one. Yeah. And it's not like your music smacks of music of Copland or anything like that in that
right.
and 30s Americana vein, but there are elements in your music, which a Danish composer, you wouldn't expect it from someone who
right.
grew up here and was immersed in all that, albeit as we talked earlier, your timeline of discovering it and playing it. Again, turning to the CD Once and Again, works of my guest today, Edward Smaldone, and his direct link to American jazz, his two-movement work for clarinet and piano titled Duke/Monk. We'll pass the Ellington inspiration and hear that second movement channeling the great Thelonious Monk. It is performed by Charles Nydick and Maury Ritt. Thank you. think we would be remiss if we didn't come to the present and what everybody's dealing with. So I just wondered if, in the midst of COVID here, how this has affected school students, I mean, just young composers. I mean, just where are we at here?
It's really tough. And, you know, along with COVID has been, you know, the realization that classical music is an especially Western European centric, which generally means white male centric genre. And I mean, frankly, you know, my music forever has involved, you know, a healthy dose of things that are not that, you know, both in terms of the importance of American jazz and American rock and soul and rhythm and blues music. That really hasn't been an issue for me, but it is an issue that needs to be addressed. And I know there are people that are working very hard for inclusion. I don't think it makes sense for me to change or try to change who I am or what I am. I hope that as we move forward and as concerts come back, I hope there'll still be room for me on the stage. I can't pretend that I'm something other than I am, but I have embraced the influence of, you know, Duke Ellington and Miles Davis and Stevie Wonder and the Ohio Players. And, you know, I mean, there's a whole raft of influences that are not Western Europe white male, but, you know, that is my heritage. I can't do much about it, but I, you know, I hope there's room on the stage for us all to share that. And when we get back to performing, you know, I'm expecting and hoping that there'll be a landscape in the future that will include live performances. You know, there's a lot of this kind of thing, this, you know, the Zoom call and the virtual connection is one that, you know, we've all had enough of it being the only thing.
Right.
But I think it's not something that's going to go away. So there will be opportunities to use the medium. There's some things that have to be solved. You know, the latency that exists in a Zoom call makes it impossible for two people to play together. But the way that it allows people to communicate with one another and then move to a performance arena is something that I think can add something, can add a dimension to the musical world.
Yeah, that was kind of prescient because my last big point here you've already covered even before I've asked it, that the classical composing world has to look at this time where the curtain has come down.
Right.
For diversity, because you and I have never experienced what some composers have felt.
Exactly.
There's bias, bigotry, you know, rejection, you know, because of some parameter, be it religion or race or gender or whatever. Right. And it is going to be a fast, I don't know how far off it still is, but it's going to be fascinating when back on how people have taken stock of this emerging world, which includes composing music.
It includes everybody. Let me just say one thing about that.
Sure.
You know, getting back to Queens College, I think Queens as a borough and Queens College as an institution has the opportunity to play a really significant role in this. When I was a student at Queens, right up until the last time I stepped foot on the campus, the diversity of the student body and the lack of boundaries or the inclusiveness of the people there is rather astounding. I mean, as director, one of the things I would very often point to is that, you know, here we have a string quartet of, it just happens to be the students that we got assigned. This kid is from Poland. This one is from Japan. There's somebody else from South America. And this one is from Bayside. So, you know, that was so normal. So, you know, just the way we did business. And I think that's, you know, possibly the best. There's a really cool development very recently, you know, the Pixar movie Soul.
Yeah.
The music educator who was the model for the character, the Joe Gardner character in that movie, is a student that graduated from Queens College and taught in Queens for 35 years. They went to his classroom. The Pixar movie modeled their classroom on his. The diversity of his classroom was what he was teaching for 35 years. He was one of my students when I was a graduate student.
That's great. That's great.
Crazy.
Yeah, it'll be a new world.
So some vocal music by my guest, Edward Smaldone, once again from the Once and Again CD. First, final minutes of a song from a three-song cycle setting Italian texts, also set by the great Renaissance composer Claudio Monteverdi. This movement is titled Piagne Sospira, She Wept and Sighed, featuring the voice of soprano Tony Arnold. Then, from the cycle Letters from Home, setting letters the composer found in a cupboard in his home on Long Island, and they were sent to a Mrs. P.H. Andrews, we'll hear the song Thank You, Luther, featuring the voice of soprano Susan Narucci.
What's ahead for you? I mean, working on anything?
Yes.
You got time to do now?
Well, you know, it's funny. This spring semester, I'm actually starting a sabbatical. So I've got a lot more time. I'm supposed to have a lot more time to do things. But teaching online, which I did last semester, is a lot of work. It's actually more work than just walking into a classroom with a marker and talking to the kids. But there were two big performances that didn't happen. Last spring, I wrote a clarinet concerto for the lifeguard wind ensemble for the Queen of Denmark. So there's a Queen's College graduate. He's actually an exchange student from Denmark. He went back to Denmark. He plays the clarinet in this ensemble. It's like the Danish equivalent of the Buckingham Palace band, you know, with big furry hats and everything. But they're amazing musicians and they give a lot of concerts in addition to doing marching. My piece is not going to be a march. Don't worry. But I wrote a concerto for them. That was supposed to be performed last June in Copenhagen. It's now been rescheduled for this coming June. So hopefully, fingers crossed, that will happen. And then I've also written a piano concerto that was scheduled for performance in New York at the Miller Theater at Columbia University. And that concerto was going to be performed by the League ISCM Orchestra. And a soloist also happens to be from Scandinavia, a guy named Niklas Sivilov, amazing pianist. And that's been postponed. We still don't quite know when that's going to happen. So I've got these two big projects that are not quite finished, which it's like I've got a, you know, these two giant pots of soup on the stove, and there's not a lot of room on the stove for anything else until I finish cooking these two. And then we'll see what happens next.
Well, congratulations as we started to interview on the recordings, and let's hope that your pots get off the stove and get performances in front of live audiences again.
That's what I'd really like. First of all, the performers on the new CD, on the Once and Again, especially these two singers, Tony Arnold and Susan Naruki, you know, I don't know what you might play, but I hope you'll put up some sound.
They're both wonderful performers. Yeah.
They'll be featured. So, you know, my life as a performer was a singing guitar player. So, you know, vocal music, it's not something that I thought I would do right away because, you know, classical music was this new thing. So everything was a string quartet or for instruments and so forth. It took me a long time before I really wrote vocal music. And this choral piece, L'Infinito, is really only the second choral piece I ever wrote. And the song cycles were also a way of really sort of me giving voice to what I think is in some ways my most natural way of making music. Which is to
say, hooking up with Harold's group. I mean, it's a really great group. So
it was amazing. You know, also, you know, setting Italian, which is my heritage, was also, you know, part of the impetus for those projects.
Well, in some fashion, I hope we get to hear a lot more of your music in the coming months and years. I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. Okay. This is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat, like we've been chatting via Zoom, of course, with someone from the past, someone you never had a chance to talk to but could. I'm just wondering when I ask that, what's the first name that pops into your head?
Wow.
But the first name that popped in, because like I say, you can get flooded with names. But
Right. They are flooding in. That's a tough one. You know what? It might be that aunt of mine who, what was the music business like? I wonder if it was really any different than it is now. You know, everybody's trying to find time to perform, trying to find time to practice, working on the next gig, you know, putting food on the table, all in the same process.
Or just what the heck were they playing in a Missouri that was borderline Wild West back around 19?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they were just playing, you know, popular music of the day. You know, it was in the days before ASCAP was formed.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of crazy.
Well, okay. Obviously, you're the first one to pick a great aunt instead of 2 years. Final question is non-musical. Everybody I interview on Cadenza in normal times fills our life with music. When you have to do something non-musical, pull yourself away, respite, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do you do?
Yikes. There are things people do other than music?
I
would probably say food.
Really?
Occupies an important part of my life. You know, cooking, eating, going to restaurants. I mean, I really loved going in New York City, you know, there's no reason to get on a plane because somewhere within 10 minutes, somebody has already gotten on a plane and brought whatever that food is to a little restaurant. And it's not being, you know, nobody's cooking out of a recipe book. These are people that used to have a restaurant in Italy or Japan or Thailand or Vietnam or somewhere. And they've just come here. And I like to cook also. I find cooking is a very, it's got instant gratification and it's a very creative thing. So we're not doing a whole lot of the stuff that I really like to do other than music. So I'm doing a lot of music.
Hence your metaphor of your kettles with your concertos on the.
Well, that's when I teach my students about things. Most of the analogies that I use in my teaching have to do with cooking or driving.
There you go.
In music, getting somewhere and how you get there and so forth. Learning how to write music is like learning how to parallel park. You can talk about it, but the only way you learn how to do it is you got to do it.
You got to do it.
Edward Smaldone, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you so much.
Composer Edward Smaldone. You can check out a little more about him by going to the homepage of the Aaron Copland School of Music at Queens College and then the faculty and staff tab. The recording Once and Again is on the New Focus label. Check it out at newfocusrecordings.com, and the Portrait CD is on the Ablaze record label, ablazerecords.net. I'll leave you, however, with music of my guest as it appears on a new Naxos CD. Check it out at naxos.com, titled Songs of Peace and Praise, Choral Music from Queens College, as performed by the New York Virtuoso Singers, led by their director and past Cadenza guest Harold Rosenbaum. Here are the closing minutes of another setting of the Italian language. L'Infinito was inspired by the beauty of the landscape of rolling hills outside Spoleto in summer 2013. Music by my guest today, Edward Smaldone. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org.